Okay, should I do our thing?
Yeah, let's do the thing.
Hi, welcome to Sisteria Untold. We are your sisters and hosts, Sabrina
and Marva.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood. We're back for, I think we can safely call this season 3 instead of season 2.25763. Because
yeah,
we've had a total of 40 episodes already, which is crazy. And
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think we can just slide right in, or not really slide, but yeah, like jump, hop, and skip into season 3.
Yeah, cannonball into season 3.
Yeah.
Well, welcome, Sabrina and listeners, to season 3 of Sistery Untold. Yay! Woo. We are so professional.
Yes. We're going to get one of those tracks that go like, and then we'll be professional.
Yeah, I bet they have that on
Anchor. That's true. Yeah. That's anywho. True.
Okay, so I think that this is one of our oldest episodes, but
like, historically.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. Sabrina.
Yes.
Do you know the Dark Ages?
Yeah, it's like the Middle Ages. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the period in Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire.
I didn't know it had like a specific event that triggered it.
Yeah. So it's like the early medieval period. Like, I think what we said before on our Medieval Queens episodes, that medieval time was like between 500 AD and 1500 AD. So this is like that beginning half.
Yeah. Okay.
This may come as a shock, but the Dark Ages, they were not actually dark.
Oh, it was a good time?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on who you're good. But I mean, like, in actuality, it wasn't dark. They still had night and day as normal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't think it was just dark for like 100 years.
I don't know. Norway and stuff, it is dark.
Yes.
So I just wanted to make sure that's clear.
Thank you. Yes. And no shame to our listeners who, up until this moment, thought it was literally dark. No shade. That's fine.
No shade. But because of this, people nowadays, historians, are often referring to this period as the early medieval period, just kind of like what I was saying.
More like objective, yeah.
Yeah, even though I'm trying to bring in hashtag make the dark ages dark again. But we'll see. Mm-hmm. It was actually not until the 1330s that the term dark ages came into being. It was brought in by this handsome guy, who I just sent you a picture of, Petrarch. And he was a scholar from Tuscany, and he wanted to make it clear that he was, like, the smartest guy out there. And he felt that the Roman period was the time of genius and cultural innovation and achievement. And since the Romans fell, Europe, with its lack of, like, pure Latin, had been in a downward spiral. Or, as you could say, an age of darkness.
Okay.
So he spent his life traveling around Europe trying to get his hands on all the Roman and Greek writings he could, because he wanted to learn and bring back Latin and classical ideals and literature and art. So that was Petrarch's mission, and in kind of doing that, you know, you have to be like, in order to make yourself a hero, you have to like have a villain, you know?
Yeah. He made the Dark Ages the villain, yeah.
In order to make the Roman time seem light and smart, he had to make something else look bad.
Yeah, and then that legacy lasted.
Yeah.
You sound so American since you were here for a few weeks. You
Do
said,
I?
Like, Latin, and usually you say, now, in the recent years, you say your T's, you say Latin. And then you, like, said, like, literature, but also, like, literature, and it just came out, like, literature.
Literature.
But that's just, I think it's funny. Anyways, that's Petrarch. Cool. Okay, so we can thank him for casting a shadow on the Dark Ages.
Yeah. There's, like, a lot more about the politics and stuff of who decides when the Dark Ages were and why they were dark. Because then there's also, of course, like the whole Catholic Protestant thing, like going mm-hmm. back and forth, being like, no, you were in the Dark Ages, and no, you were in the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, new ways of thinking are always better than previous ones. That's in quotes, like a...
Yeah, like allegedly.
You know, yeah, allegedly. But so, if you want to know more about the Dark Ages, I suggest that you Google it.
Yes.
But like I said now, most historians don't really use the term Dark Ages, but some do to refer to the fact that there was just not that many, like, sources
yeah.
available to us about the time period. So it's kind of, like, dark in an unknown kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And I do think, like, just, like, the discovery of, like, classical, like, ancient, like, Roman and ancient Greek texts is, like, what, and, like, art and everything is, like, what kind of, like, sparked the Renaissance and, like, all this, like, new thought that eventually led us to the Enlightenment and, like, all those things. So it's, like, it is helpful that these kind of, the Dark Ages ended, you know, and it became, like, yeah. a more enlightened time eventually. In the course of, like, 500 years, but, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, though, like, would people have still gotten to an enlightened stage if they had not rediscovered these old things, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, where maybe a new Light Ages would have come.
Yeah.
But who knows? Yes. Okay, the other thing that people still use it to refer to is kind of, like, to talk about the problems of the era, and that's what we're gonna dig a little bit deeper into today. Mm-hmm. During this time period, there were people moving all over the place. The Roman Empire, who had been, like, a huge power for so long, was crumbling. Germanic tribes, like the Goths, were moving south and creating new kingdoms.
And
the
Huns is this, were forming. Like, 500, 600?
This is, like, before 500. This is, okay. like, as Rome is, like, falling.
Okay, okay.
And then the Huns, who were from Asia, they formed, like, loads of alliances, and they were, like, moving west and creating, like, a big empire. And then that was also then forcing the Germanic tribes that had moved south now to move west into Rome. Mm. Not Rome the city, but Rome the empire.
Yeah.
Which was causing, like, lots of conflict, and, like, at first Rome was like, okay, yeah, we'll take you guys in, but then they're like, oh, we can't control you, and it just was kind of a mess. And on top of that, everything is getting really cold. Research has shown that in the Northern Hemisphere, between about 400 AD and 765, temperatures were a-dropping. And then this may have led to suffering agriculture and then therefore declining populations. And so things are just, like, very unstable politically, food-wise, emotionally. Yeah.
And if I don't have food, I'm going to cause some political turmoil and also yeah. emotional turmoil. So
yeah.
they're all connected.
Yes. In the year 395, the last Roman emperor died and he split the empire in two. The west was taken over by the warring Germanic kingdoms and the east became the Byzantine Empire. And we're actually going to talk more about the Byzantine side in my next episode, but today
okay, cool.
we're staying west.
I do want to know more about the Byzantine Empire. All I know is that Istanbul was Constantinople. Istanbul. That's all I know.
Yeah, that was meant to be my episode for this week, but it was just, like, too much research, and I was like, this is never going to be done.
Okay, so stay tuned.
Yes, so... Along with the cold, the lack of food, the wars, things in the West are pretty chaotic. And they're going to stay that way for the story of today's sisters. Two queens who inspired legends and whose rivalry literally almost destroyed a kingdom and went down in history.
Get it, girls.
Yes. So, we're first going to meet Brunhilde.
Beautiful name.
Everything about this is, like, foreign to me. So all of the names are strange, in my opinion. All of the names of these countries, even though they're, like, in modern-day places, they're all completely, like, different names and stuff. So I'm sending you here a map this will be on the blog, so this is just for your reference.
Thank you. Okay. So, wow. Yeah, this is very different. So we have the Saxons in the north. Okay, this is continental Europe. Okay, I didn't know Saxons were from so far. I guess, because that's not Germany, is it? What is this? Let me look up, like, a normal map.
So this is kind of, like, there's, like, Spain here at the bottom. There's France kind of here. Well, it's now France and, like, Belgium and stuff like that in the middle. Italy down here. The Kingdom of the Lombards is Italy.
I see. Okay. Okay, there's some similar, like, familiar things, like Burgundy and Lyon in France. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of, like, going into, like, Switzerland area.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, yeah, some familiar names, I guess. Aquitaine, didn't we talk about a woman from Aquitaine?
Yeah, Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah. Okay.
She was around the 1100s.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Thank you.
There's not that much to say about Brunhilde's childhood, because she was born probably in the year 543, which is a long time ago, and... Like I was saying, I think that this is our oldest ep, other than, like, the Hawaiian Goddesses episode, mm-hmm. but is there anything that I'm missing?
I don't think so. I think the oldest thing I've done is, like, 1100s mm-hmm. in my R1 Asma episode. Went a little mm-hmm. bit further back just to talk about, like, how, like, the caliphate was established in, like, the Middle East, but, yeah, I think this is, like, our oldest story.
Yeah.
For, like, two individual human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, just with that said, there's not a whole lot to say about her childhood. But I do know she was most likely born in central Spain. What's today Spain on this map is the Kingdom of the Visigoths, in their capital city of Toledo. Her parents were Aethengild and Goswina. And she had a sister, Galswina. All crazy names.
Yeah. I can't help you there.
Aethengild, who was her father, he became the Visigoth king of Hispania and Septimania after he rebelled against his predecessor when Brunhilde was about 11. So then at age 11, she becomes a princess. Her mother, she was not any kind of, like, soft-spoken queen consort chilling on the side. Mm-hmm. And as they only had daughters, when Aethengild died in 567, she remarried to his successor's brother, okay. who, like, wasn't her son because they only had daughters.
Yes, got it.
Yeah. And so then when the brother, her new brother-in-law, died, she became queen again. Because her new husband took the throne.
That was a strategic move, like playing the long game a little bit. Like, I'm not going to marry the successor. That's, like, power hungry. I'll marry the successor's brother, slip a little bit of powder in his drink, and then, oh, I'm the queen again. Yeah.
Oh, Sabrina, you don't even know how accurate you are.
Oh, my gosh.
So just a little bit of insight into Gothsmina's personality. In her later life, when her granddaughter was sent to marry her stepson and become the next queen, she wanted the granddaughter to convert to her religion. And the granddaughter's about age 12 at this time. And she refuses to convert. We're going to hear this name a lot. Gregory of Tours. He was like a chronicler of the day.
Okay.
He said
I love a
that
historic historian. Their writing is the craziest.
Yes, he described an incident saying, "The queen has lost her temper completely, and she seized the girl by her hair, threw her to the ground, then she kicked her until she was covered with blood, had her stripped naked, and ordered her to be thrown into the baptismal pool."
And she was 12?
Yeah, and this is her own granddaughter.
Gosh. Oh my gosh, that's so evil.
Her granddaughter who's about to become her daughter-in-law.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, so that just gives you a little insight, maybe into her personality. I don't know how she raised her daughters, but she doesn't sound like the sweetest of ladies.
A gentle-handed caretaker. Yeah.
Yes. And then of her stepsons, one of them rebelled against the king, and he was defeated and executed. The other one inherited the throne, and Goswina was caught conspiring against him. So, you know, with a mother like that, who needs enemies?
She is power hungry.
So, Brunhilde grew up as an Arian Christian, but in 567, she married King Siegbert of Austrasia.
Okay, I see that on the map as well. I definitely thought that just said Austria.
Yeah, I thought that for the longest time too, and then I kept reading it as Australasia, but then it's also not that, so.
Yeah. So that's somewhere in, like, North France, like, kind of near the German border today, looks like.
Siegbert and he had three brothers, so between him and his brothers, they were all Frankish kings. So this whole, like, orange bit is, like, a Frankish kingdom run by the Merngovian dynasty, which is Siegbert's family.
Okay.
So when Siegbert's father died, they all divided up the land into four different kingdoms. And so Siegbert ruled the eastern part, which was parts that are now of Western Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands and Luxembourg. And I felt like it sounds really big, but then when you look at the map, it's like, no.
Well, Luxembourg is, like, tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all really close together.
Yeah, and it's just, I feel like it just goes kind of around, like, incorporates little bits of each of them.
Mm-hmm.
Brunhilde marrying King Siegbert was actually kind of unusual because the Frankish kings, they normally didn't marry, like, other royalty. They didn't marry princesses. They normally married, like, a low-born girl.
Oh, interesting.
Siegbert actually had, you know, his kind of medium-sized kingdom, but he had a very large ambition, and he spent months negotiating his marriage to Brunhilde. She was a catch. She was 18 years old. She was a foreign princess who was said to be beautiful, and she would have come with a nice dowry. And as a morgengave, which is a mourning gift that was a traditional gift after a couple consummated their marriage from the groom to the bride, Siegbert gave her an estate in southern France.
Ooh, that is a nice gift. Yeah, I want a morgengave.
I will take two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Siegbert had all of his brothers. One brother in particular, Chilperic, is going to play a big role in our story here. He ruled in the west in Neustria, and he, in the end, married Brunhilde's sister, Galswena. He, I would say, is a little bit of a bad guy. He basically married Galswena because he was jealous of his brother's royal marriage, and he was able to negotiate this marriage with Brunhilde and Galswena's father by offering the entire southern third of his kingdom to Galswena as a mourning gift.
Oh my gosh. Definitely outdid his brothers.
Yeah. So then, of course, Brunhilde's father is like, yeah, sure.
I also just love this, like, kind of reverse dowry thing, where it's like, mm-hmm. you give them land. Yeah.
Yeah. Siegbert and Chilperic, they, you know, have their problems. They would go on to spend much of their life fighting with each other, you know, always trying to outdo one another. However, the feud between the brothers was nothing compared to the feud that would begin between Brunhilde and Chilperic's wife.
Oh, so that's her sister, right?
Well, luckily and unluckily, no, it's not her sister.
Okay.
When Galswena married Chilperic, she ordered all of his mistresses to leave, but this did not go over very well with him and his mistresses. So when Galswena then died under suspicious circumstances, she was strangled in her bed while she slept next to her husband.
That's very suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Brunhilde knew who to blame, and her name was Fredegund.
And this is, I'm guessing, a mistress of the king?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about Fredegund right now. Yes, So Fredegund, her background is even more spotty than Brunhilde's, and this is because she was not raised a princess, but she was actually raised as a slave.
Oof.
And it's not every day that a slave girl rises to be queen, but Fredegund was no ordinary woman.
Yeah, she should write a memoir.
Yeah.
Rags to riches story.
Yeah. A how-to book.
Yeah.
She was likely taken as a slave in her youth, and with all the constant battles and fighting during this kind of really turbulent time period, this was not uncommon. She was possibly sent down from the north for sale by wagon, in a wagon cart with her arms bound by rope, and she was brought into the royal household to work as a kitchen servant. But as she is known to do, she caught the eye of someone very important. The queen, Audovera, who was Chilperic's first wife. And Audovera decided to make her a, like, servant.
Like a lady's maid?
I mean, I don't know. It didn't say that specific. Like, I don't really know what their kind of customs are. But yeah, bring her more into the royal household.
Okay.
So, in the royal household, though, probably not to Adovera's pleasure, Fredegund was now also in the eyesight of the king. We're just going to lay this out there right now. Fredegund is a woman whose ambition knows no bounds. Okay. She was ready to take action when any opportunity arose. And so I don't know when or how she first became the mistress of the king, but when she does, she becomes his favorite. While Chilperic is away, Queen Audovera gives birth to a child. And so this is a story that is referenced in Liber Historiae Francorum, which is like a history of the Franks. So as the story goes, Fredegund helped Audovera prepare for the baptism of her new child. And Fredegund learned that it was forbidden for a mother to receive her own child in her arms after a baptism due to a canon law forbidding marriage between parents and godparents. I don't see how that makes sense, but
wait,
this is what it
says.
Wait,
so the mom can't hold her baby after baptism?
Yeah, like she can't, like, after the baby's baptized, you can't hand it back to the mother. You're supposed to hand it back, I guess, to the godparents.
Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
And so Fredegund, as Adovera's servant, arranged the events of the baptism in a way that Audovera unknowingly broke this taboo. So then, on Chilperic's return, Fredegund informed him of what Audovera had done, and Chilperic committed Audovera to a convent.
Oh my gosh. That is so extreme.
Yeah. So, it seems at this point that Chilperic could have been... So it seems like, you know, now Fredegund could have her way, Chilperic could be all hers, but instead... Chilperic marries Galsuina.
I guess because he wants to marry not a commoner.
Yeah, because now he gets all, like, worked up by his brother's marriage to Brunhilde, and now he's like, I want a princess bride, and I'm sure Fredegund is like, excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
But so, yeah, so Chilperic marries Galsuina, and Fredegund does still not back down, though. The chronicler of the time I mentioned before, Gregory of Tours, wrote, Chilperic ordered Galsuina to be strangled and found her dead on the bed. So, short and sweet, we know Chilperic had her killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we know if Fredegund played a role in her death for sure? No. But would it be her first time disposing of a rival for the king's affections? Also, no.
No.
And it would also be only the beginning of a long and bloody battle for power. There was no investigation into Galsuina's death, and no message from the king announcing her demise. Instead, a few days later, Chilperic and Fredegund were married, while Fredegund wore Galsuina's own clothes.
Oh my gosh. That is messed up.
Yeah, so Fredegund finally got her man, but in marriage, she gained a sister-in-law with a vendetta. Now we get to our rivalry of Queen Brunhilde and Queen Fredegund. And let me just tell you, neither of these women are to be trifled with. So, although I just spent this whole beginning of this episode, like, explaining why the Dark Ages weren't actually dark, things are about to get dark.
Okay.
In what I feel is a totally reasonable response, Brunhilde is obviously not happy with her whole sister being murdered by her brother-in-law situation.
Yeah.
And, I mean, would that be enough to go to war over? Probably, in my opinion, yes. But Brunhilde also has other reasons. Galswintha's mourning gift, the one-third of Chilperic's kingdom that he gave to her. By standards of the time, and probably our standards, it should then pass to her family. But she didn't have any children, so Brunhilde thinks, well, she's my sister, so that land should now be mine.
Yeah.
Which, fair, but in the biggest shocker ever, Chilperic and Fredegund don't feel the same way.
I just always feel like war is just, like, the most unfair solution. It's like, oh, like, I, a rich queen, want this other dead rich queen's land, so I'm gonna, and, like, I'm just gonna go kill a bunch of commoners, and, like, but you and the king you're fighting against are just, like, sitting at home. Like, that's not really fair. Making other people fight your battles for you.
Yeah, I agree in principle, but that's not always going to be the case in this story.
Oh, okay.
So, reserve your judgment for the end. Mm-hmm. Brunhilde's husband, Siegbert, and one of his other brothers, they decide to invade Chilperic's land to get what they say should belong to Brunhilde. And things are going well. By the year 575, Siegbert and Brunhilde have taken up residence in Paris, and Chilperic has had to flee. But I'm just going to tell you right now that this Battle of the Queens goes on for literally decades.
Oh, wow.
So
this is also, we're only, like, just getting started. Brother against brother thing, too.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
Like, that they sided with their wives more than each other.
Yeah, but I feel like from the beginning, I'm not convinced that Siegbert and Chilperic really liked each other that much. Like, they were very competitive, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay. At what might be the time another queen would count her blessings for escaping with her life, Fredegund, while she's in hiding, has not stopped plotting. And so this next part is going to sound like fiction, but if we believe Gregory of Tours, where most of this information comes from, then it is just truth that is wilder than fiction. Okay. Fredegund calls two slave boys into where she's in hiding and gives them a mission, to assassinate King Siegbert. It was, at this time and place, like, very common for men and boys to carry knives around, and so at, like, this time period, a boy walking around with a knife isn't even really seen as being armed. It's just seen as, like, a boy.
Yeah.
But this is Fredegund, so she's gonna need some insurance. She provides the boys with poison, probably wolfsbane or snake venom, which she knew a fair amount about, because she had spent, like, all her time reading ancient medical texts, and so she knew a lot about poisons and how to make them and how to get them.
Oh, wow.
And so with these particular poisons, you just... yeah, you should like that. Academic.
Yeah.
And with these particular poisons, you just need, like, a little bit of contact for it to be fatal. So... she sends the boys out. They arrive at the camp of Siegbert, and they smeared the poisons on their blades. They looked pretty harmless because they were children, and they weren't, like, wearing armor or anything, so they were able to get close to Siegbert because his bodyguards didn't really see them as a threat. One of the boys was able to get a small cut on Siegbert, and that was all it took. Within minutes, he was dead.
Wow.
That's so the crazy. Boys also died.
Yeah, I figured they would get caught.
Yeah, they got caught, like, immediately. But so, with Siegbert dead, this led to two things happening. Fredegund and Chilperic were able to come out of hiding and take their lands back, and Brunhilde needed to flee and remarry. And in a slightly awkward twist, she married her nephew-in-law, Chilperic, and his first wife's son, because they shared a common enemy in Fredegund.
That's a weird marriage. Okay. Dang.
Yeah. And even at this time, that marriage was the no-no, so it was pretty quickly annulled.
Oh, okay, okay.
But without a husband, Brunhilde could have quickly lost power, which is probably what Fredegund would have thought would have happened, but she obviously didn't know Brunhilde very well. Killing Siegbert actually only made Brunhilde more powerful because she had a young son, and she became regent during his youth. And, yeah, so now she's queen all on her own. Yeah. She doesn't have a husband, she doesn't have anybody that she's answering to.
Yeah.
During her regency, Brunhilde did do a lot of good for her country. She brought, like, a lot of structure and public works to her kingdom that was, like, still kind of suffering from the, like, results of the collapse of the Roman Empire. And she also just, like, really enjoyed the power. She ruled on her own until her son came of age, and then she ruled with him as an adult. And in order to ensure that she held on to her power, she also was always trying to prevent him from getting married. So she would just, like, supply him with concubines.
Oh, gosh. She's not like a regular mom. She's a cool mom.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
And then, I don't know, I mean, luckily, unluckily, I don't know. He died at age 26, and Brunhilde became regent once more.
I wouldn't really consider that lucky.
Yeah, but for Brunhilde, I feel like her vibe is queen first, mother second, yeah. You know? And so she's a bit like, well, I get to be queen again. Because now she's queen regent again because she has a grandson who's also like a baby.
Yeah.
So, despite all of these other things going on in Brunhilde's life, she has not forgotten her old enemies, Fredegund and Chilperic. Since Chilperic and Fredegund had returned to their thrones, Fredegund had also gained more power. Her husband was so grateful for, like, her saving them that he made her one of his chief advisors, and she influenced everything from domestic policy to military strategy.
Okay, we do love a girl boss, so got a shout out.
Yeah. And they certainly had their ups and downs in this time as well. In 580, an epidemic of dysentery hit their kingdom, and two of her sons actually died from it. And she believed that this was due to her sins, so she tried to atone for them by burning some tax documents that she felt were unjust. This obviously didn't work, though, because the sons died.
Yeah.
And she also had a fairly contentious relationship with her daughter, who I'm going to send you a picture right now. Thank you. So this picture kind of represents what...
Who's who? Let me just explain what I'm seeing right now. So it's some kind of old castle. There's, like, a chest, like, it looks like one of those chests you get, like, when you're gonna get married, like, where it has all your fancy jewels and clothes in there. And one girl is smushing another girl inside the chest, like, her head and upper body.
Yeah. So that's, in this picture, it's supposed to be Fredegund smashing her daughter into the chest.
To kill her?
I think to teach her a lesson, you know.
Oh my gosh.
And if she dies as a result, you know, it's her own fault. It's probably her sins. But so, yeah, that's just a little example of...
her relationship with her daughter. Yeah.
Yeah, her mother-daughter relationship. But Fredegund was also not afraid to splash the cash when she wanted to. When her daughter got married, she sent, like, this whole, like, entourage with, like, carts and carriages filled with jewels and stuff to, like, send her off away to her new life. And everybody was kind of like, this is a bit excessive. But she was like, I don't care.
Mm. Okay. Love hard, hate hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the year 580, Fredegund later had Adovera, the first wife, and Adovera's son Clovis murdered as well. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they lived this way from 575 until about 584, when Chilperic was assassinated. Do we know who did it for sure? No. Do we have a pretty good guess?
Yes.
Brunhilde.
Oh, I was thinking yes. His own wife. Okay, okay. That makes more sense. I was like, she really wants power. Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past either of them. But it's kind of like, recognize that likely it was Brunhilde.
Yeah, she has more of a motive.
Yeah. With Chilperic dead, and Fredegund with only one living son left, who was still a child, she too became regent of her kingdom. So now there was nothing left between Fredegund and Brunhilde besides a land border and one other brother-in-law desperate to keep the peace.
Oh, gosh. Stay out of it.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm not envious of your position. So, according to Smithsonian Magazine, the eldest brother of Siegbert and Chilperic was Guntram, who ruled over Burgundy, which was like the kingdom to the south of Austrasia and Neustria.
Yeah.
He was a widower with no surviving sons, and the queens competed for his favor, hoping that he would pick one of their sons as his sole heir.
To, like, reunite the kingdoms a bit.
Yeah, well, because if, you know, one of their sons gets two kingdoms, then, you know, they have, like, double the land, double the power.
Yeah.
And as you can probably tell, neither of these queens has any amount of chill. So over these years, they were anything but peaceful. They were constantly having, like, little battles breaking out all over the place, oftentimes under guises of different reasons, but it was somehow always, when it came down to it, Brunhilde and Fredegund against each other. Even if it was, like, they had problems with, like, a third party, then the other one would just join in with the enemy, you know? Yeah. Like, at one point, Brunhilde had trouble with the Visigoths in Spain, even though she was a Visigoth originally. I'm not going to get into, like, why they had these problems, but the Visigoths then wrote to Fredegund to make an alliance, which Fredegund was obviously all too happy to oblige. And then she told them, like, hey, like, let's raise the stakes here and just assassinate Brunhilde.
Oh my gosh.
The plot of which, of course, did not succeed, so their rivalry continued for another couple decades.
How old are they at this point? Oh my gosh.
So, yeah, they're, like, in their 40s, and this was something that I...
Okay, yeah, I guess they got married when they're, like, 18, so, yeah.
Yeah, there's one thing that I didn't actually put in, but it was interesting, that was... Talking about, and, you know, at this time, this is from Smithsonian Magazine, both queens were now in their late 40s, and middle age is a liminal space for women in any era, but even more so for Moravian. According to Frankish law, each person was assigned a monetary value, which their family could demand in compensation if the person was killed. A young woman's value was generally higher than a man's. But once the woman was no longer able to bear children, her price usually went down considerably from, like, 600 solidi, which I guess is their currency, to about 200.
Wow. That's so interesting. It's kind of like life insurance, I guess. But this is, like, so interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It says also the economic value of an aging queen was tallied a bit differently. For example, Brunhilde's mother had remarried her second king while in her 40s, and he was not expecting her to provide children, but political expertise. So, freed from the business of pregnancy and birthing, a queen's value might actually go up.
Yeah.
Because she had, you know, experience and allies and family and all that kind of stuff. That was just an interesting thing about middle age.
Yeah.
Women in the middle age.
Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah, I had no idea about that. That's so interesting.
Don't thank me. Thank the Smithsonian.
Thank you, Smithsonian.
Things did finally, though, come to a head after the brother of Burgundy, Guntram, died. He died of natural causes at the ripe old age of like 60 something, which was like old for a king back then. After, you know, just like having years of the back and forth and conflict with Brunhilde and Fredegund, in the end left his kingdom to Brunhilde's son. There, he at different times was, you know, like a little bit more supporting one than the other, but at the time of his death, he just happened to be more on Brunhilde's side, kind of thing. Brunhilde, though, basically, although it's technically left to her son, she's basically the one who's ruling.
Of course. How could she resist?
Yeah. She's now ruling two kingdoms. Brunhilde set out to have a peaceful transition of power, and she let the Burgundians keep some of their, like, political roles and stuff. She did bring in her own advisors and stuff, but she didn't, like, just completely, like, wipe them out and take it over.
That's good. Like, least you can do, because it's like, you didn't conquer this kingdom. And it's also not yours. It's your grandson's. But, yeah.
Yeah. So, for the first year after Guntram's death, things were actually going pretty well. Brunhilde is loving her expanded power. Fredegund is doing her thing in Neustria, which is mostly, like, plotting and assassinating people. But, you know, you do you.
Whatever sparks joy.
So, yeah, in 593, though, things start to escalate very quickly. Brunhilde is on her little bit of a power trip, and she decides to attack one of Fredegund's cities that was on the border of their two countries. It's called, it's a town called Soissons.
Just let sleeping dogs lie. Like, what's all this about?
They can't, though. So, Soissons was a wealthy town that had once been the capital of Fredegund's kingdom, but she had taken to ruling from Paris, so it was a bit left on its own. And so, again, this is from the Smithsonian article. Brunhilde sent Duke Wintrio of Champagne, along with some of the nobles from both Austrasia and Burgundy, to invade villages and towns surrounding Soissons. The countryside was devastated by their attacks, and, like, they burned all the crops and everything to the ground. Fredegund then got one of her supporters, this guy Landeric, to marshal what forces he could and decided to march out with the men, which was not normal.
She Things went don't with usually the men. Like.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
See, I told you, she's not just sending people out to do her dirty work. Yeah. She's like, I am the dirty one. Fredegund just, like, you know, changed the script, whether it was because she, like, had to, because she didn't have enough soldiers and people were attacking her, or whether it's because she, you know, is a bit crazy and is like, let me do this. Don't know. She and Landeric and the troops that they had been able to gather, they marched to Berny Riviere, which was once her husband's favorite villa and situated just outside Soissons. And there she let the men raid, like, the treasury rooms and the storerooms, and, like a traditional barbarian king, distributed valuables amongst the soldiers. She didn't want the riches to fall into the hands of the Austrasians. She also wanted to, like, pay the men in advance to, like, make them really motivated to do this fight, because she thought they were gonna be nervous once they got there and realized that they were terribly outnumbered.
Yeah.
So, Fredegund had no hope of beating the opposing forces in outright combat. She decided that to defend Soissons, she would take the fight to the enemy camp, 15 miles away from the fields of Droisy. I don't know. Whatever.
It sounds like you're saying Droisy? New Jersey with, like, a Jersey accent. Like, Droisy.
New Droisy. Yes, it's Droizy, if anyone wants to pronounce that in French.
No volunteers.
Okay. Her only chance to win was to do a surprise attack. Fredegund followed the dictums of military handbooks, such as De Re Militari, and fought the same way a male Roman field commander would. She chose the battlefield and opted for trickery when confronted by a much larger army. She ordered her army to march at night, which was not typical, and she also counseled her men to disguise themselves So they had a row of warriors lead the march, like walking, and they were all carrying tree branches to camouflage the horse, like the cavalry, you know, the men on horses behind them.
This happens in Macbeth.
Yeah.
Like, they dress up like the forest. Because, like, the witches have prophesied that, like, Macbeth will never fall until Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane. And then, like, he sees, like, this forest, like, walking towards him. And he's like, oh, no, like, the forest is coming here. So, I wonder if this story, like influenced that at all.
Yeah. Fredegund and Brunhilde's stories, like, they inspired many, many different, like, stories throughout the world. She also added bells onto the horses because bells were put on horses when they were out to graze. So then she thought the enemy might hear the horses and hear the ringing and just be like, oh, it's just some horses.
Oh, that's so clever. Oh my gosh. Even though it's louder, it's like a different kind of noise. Wow. So smart.
Yeah. So, Fredegund was successful. Her army saved Soissons, and then they even went on the offensive, riding east and getting nearly 40 miles into Austrasia territory, making it all the way to Reims. And in retribution for the damage done to Soissons, Gregory, our good old friend, says that she set fire to Champagne and devastated it. Her armies plundered the villages of the area, and when Fredegund returned home, she did so like a true Frankish warrior, with much booty and many spoils. Yeah, so, although we don't know when Fredegund was born, we do know that she died a reasonably old woman for the time. Her feud with Brunhild lasted at least 30 years, so that's a pretty long life just in feud. And she died of natural causes in Paris in the year 597 with her son Clothar II on the throne. Brunhilde held on to power longer than anyone would have expected. She was in her 70s when she took the throne again as regent for the third time to her great-grandson.
Dang!
Yes, and she caused trouble all the way till the very end. She was known for setting her grandsons against each other to, like, have them fight and, you know, kind of be warring with each other in a way that helped her hold on to power. But although by the year 613, Fredegund had been long dead, she was still not done with Brunhilde. Clothar II, Fredegund's son, accused Brunhilde of being responsible for the deaths of no fewer than 10 Frankish kings, including Siegbert, which we know that she didn't actually kill, that was Fredegund, and then also of Chilperic. And he sentenced her to death. And she apparently was mounted on the back of a camel, paraded through the army, and then torn apart by wild horses.
Whoa.
And
wait, do horses even tear people? Why would a horse tear someone apart? They eat grass.
It's like, you know, when they horse-drawn and care.
Oh, like, it was? Horse okay, drawn like that kind
of quarter someone.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah, and then they cremated her body, basically.
Wow. I mean, she lived a full life, so.
Yeah. I mean, what a way to die. I mean, go big, I guess. So yeah, that's the story of Fredegund and Brunhilde, and some of you listeners may be asking, is any of this true? And some others of you may be asking, like Sabrina was asking, why does this seem so familiar? Which I can answer both questions for you. Most of this information comes from the 8th century book that I mentioned earlier, Liber Historiae Francorum, or Book of History of the Franks, which is based off of the 6th century book, Historia Francorum, which was written by our good friend Gregory of Tours. So, if you believe everything that Gregory says, then everything that I've just told you is fact. But, is Gregory the most reliable source in the entire world?
Yeah. He's also writing like 200 years later. After.
No, Gregory, he's a 6th century.
Oh, he is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Gregory was, he was there. And I think that, to me, the biggest, like, thing is that Gregory doesn't seem to be a fan of Fredegund. Mm. So everything that Gregory writes is like, Fredegund is the devil. Mm. And in his writings, he never really says that much negative stuff about Brunhilde because he's very biased. Mm-hmm. He, you know, says that, like, the way that Fredegund won that war was, like, by using witchcraft, and he, like, just accuses her of all sorts of things.
He's a hater.
Yeah, there's also Fredegund's own son. He set about kind of, like, just removing everything about Fredegund and about Brunhilde from the records, from memory. I think it seems like he, you know, liked his mom because he then killed Brunhilde over her. Yeah. But at the same time, I think he was kind of like, my mom, my aunt, they're both crazy. Let's close the chapter on this. Mm-hmm. And then also after, there's the whole, obviously, like, powerful women in history, we have to, like, make sure that this never happens again. So a lot of their kind of reputations were made to be even more like I'm not gonna lie, they don't sound like the nicest people in the world.
Yeah.
But were made, you know, even more dramatic to kind of
vilify them. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, be an example of, like, this is why we can't have female rulers. Like, look at what they're up to.
Yeah, they'll just, like, have a cat fight for 40 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And Fredegund kind of made her, they kind of made her into this, like, femme fatale kind of character who, you know, is, like, seducing and killing people. Mm-hmm. And Brunhilde into this, like, unfeeling, no maternal instinct, just here for the power. Which, if you just look at the actions that are written by Gregory, mm-hmm. it does kind of look that way.
Yeah.
But it's like, obviously they were real people who have real feelings and probably felt other things that Gregory didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And didn't feel the need to write down because they're not, like, important. Like, oh, had a tea party with her daughter today. Like, you're not going to, like, put that in a history book.
Yeah. And then, so, yeah, Brunhilde is kind of, the name, at least, Brunhilde, became a lot more famous because she became kind of a legend of, a Visigoth princess goddess kind of thing. In Norse tradition, she's a shield maiden or a valkyrie who appears as a main character in the Volsunga saga and some, like, long poems.
Mm-hmm.
And in continental Germanic tradition, she's, like, a central character in all these stories. She's a powerful Amazon-like queen. And there's an opera by Richard Wagner where Brunhild is an important, like, main character. And so
interesting.
A lot of the perceptions of Brunhilde now are also based off of, like, these, you know, myth stories and then this opera and then, you know, so her character is quite far away from her real life.
For sure.
And then Fredegund, she also took her place in myths, like you were saying, the walking forest strategy appeared more than 1,000 years later in Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Oh, you wrote that down? Like, you have,
I didn't write it down. The Smithsonian wrote it down.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Look at me.
Yeah.
I was like, I feel like that was so random. I was like, but because, like, Macbeth's a Scottish play. So I was like, oh, it's probably not actually based on that. That's so funny. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like it. There's, like, other stories, like, hundreds of years later about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever his name is, Shakespeare,
may
not have heard specifically of Fredegund doing this, but it's, like, the original story that inspired stories and stories and stories kind of thing. There's, a lot more, like, crazy stuff that they do that I didn't really, like, get that into because it becomes, like, very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's the story of Fredegund and Brunhilde.
Thank you for that. And, yeah, I'm definitely excited to see some of the more side stories on our Instagram.
Yes.
But yeah, that's so cool. Definitely super long ago. It's, like, even kind of hard for me to, like, picture it just because I'm, like, everything must have been so different. Like, you know.
Yeah.
What is this, like 1500 years ago? But yeah, it was super interesting. And yeah, I love that they're just like power hungry. I know that's your favorite kind of woman. So it was like super interesting.
Yeah, I think it was just one that I was like, this just gets crazier and crazier.
Yeah.
And like, I only found them because I Googled medieval queen sisters.
Okay.
Yeah. And there they were. Yeah. And I was like, oh, you guys are just waiting crazy and super interesting. Yeah. So,
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for that, sistery. Okay, yeah, and the only announcement I have, unless you have any other announcements, Marva, is that we're going to be guest starring, hosting, whatever, on the Three Gossip
Girls. I think let's go with starring.
Okay. We're going to be guest starring, making a surprise appearance, whatever you want to call it, on the Three Gossip Girls podcast in the coming weeks. So, super excited to talk about just Gossip Girl in general, but also kind of like sisterhood and themes on that show. So definitely tune in and just, you know, listen to them if you like them, if you're interested in Gossip Girl in general. Yeah.
It's the best show ever, so
definitely.
If you're not interested, better be interested, you should be.
If you have any taste. Just kidding.
Yeah.
But yeah. So anything else, Marva?
No, I mean, I know we'll have a new episode from you next, and then the week after, we'll have another episode from the same time period, talking about the Byzantine side of the former Roman Empire. So, it's a little bit of a theme going on, so make sure to tune in for that.
Yeah, that'll be super exciting. And, yeah. Okay, awesome. We will check in with you guys next week. And yeah. Have a good day, Marva. I don't know why this never gets less awkward.
Never, ever, ever.
Okay.
Okay, well, listeners, that's all from us. We will speak to you again in the future.
Farewell.
Have a good day or evening.
Buongiorno. Okay.
Okay. Bon voyage.
Yes. Okay, ready? Hi, welcome to Sisteria Untold. We are your sisters and hosts, Sabrina
and Marva.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood.